Thanks for the introduction and good morning, everyone. Today, I'm very glad to have this opportunity to do this presentation here. And my name is Chang Hao Yi. I'm a PhD student in Center for Quantum Information and Control, University of New Mexico. And today's topic is spectral analysis of product formulas for quantum simulation. And the talk is about 55 minutes. So this work is based on some of the joint paper with me and my mentor, Debes Croissant, and we are both members in Center for Quantum Information Control. If you want to contact us with today's topic, you can email us with the address below. So the outline of the talk is as follows. We'll begin with some of the basic preliminaries about product formula, which is a very common algorithm for Hamiltonian simulation. And then we'll introduce a method, which we call the effective Hamiltonian method to do some error analysis. And in some special situations, we obtain better results comparing to the standard approach. And also as an implication, we successfully reduce the circuit complexity of quantum phase estimation. So after the analysis about the time independent situation, we will switch attention to the time dependent Hamiltonian. And more specifically, we'll look into the simulation of adiabatic evolution. And our main contribution is the comparison between the discrete adiabatic process and the continuous version. We found that sometimes, even if the time step is very large, the state evolved under the discrete adiabatic process is still very close to the state we want. And finally, we'll mention another work, the robustness of local observer simulation. It's not our work, but it's kind of related, and we definitely want to work on it in the future. So let's start with some of the discussion about quantum simulation. So quantum simulation is one of the most important and promising application of quantum computer. The original idea comes from Richard Feynman. So if we want to simulate a quantum system, and because of the curse of dimensionality, the dimension of the Hamiltonian will grow exponentially with the size of the system, which makes it intractable for a classical computer. But however, for a quantum computer, using the power of entanglement, potentially we can reduce the complexity a lot. So the task of quantum simulation is to construct the time evolution operator in terms of local unitary gates. And basically wants to solve this Schrodinger equation. And in the matrix representation, it is equivalent to construct the unitary operator for some Hamiltonian and some simulation time t. And there are a lot of reasons why we care about this task, because it has a lot of applications. For example, in quantum chemistry and condensed matter physics, we can use quantum simulation to predict the properties of materials. And also in high energy physics, we can use it to simulate lattice gauge theory. And for quantum algorithms, for now, there are mainly three types of algorithms for the Hamiltonian simulation. And they are product formula method, and a combination of unitaries method, and a quantum signal processing method. So quantum signal processing sometimes is also called quantization, which has become a hot topic recently. And each of these methods has their advantages and disadvantages. So for product formula, the advantage is it's very concise. It does not use any encyclic bit. It doesn't have a long range entanglement gate. So it's very suitable for NISQ quantum computer. But the disadvantage is its error scaling is not as good as the other two. So in the asymptotic region, it will require more resources to simulate the Hamiltonian. And today's topic will focus only on the product flow method, but some of the results should be naturally extended to the two other methods. So here is a basic preliminaries about product formula. And in quantum simulation, we basically want to construct a unitary operator. And in this method, we first divided this unitary operator into the product of a list of short time evolution. And then we approximate each short time evolution with a good approximation of it. So here, the little t is our simulation time. The big R, which we call the shorter number, it's the name shorter comes from another name of product formula. Sometimes it's also called shorter Suzuki formula. And the delta t is the time step, and this three quantity is satisfied linear relation. And the product formula can help us to approximate each short time evolution operator with only local quantum gates. And so here's how we do it. Let's consider a general normalized Hamiltonian, which is the summation of local terms. We first separate the local terms into several different layers, such that in each layer, it's only the summation of local community terms. For example, in transfer-field IC model, we can separate the local terms into the Pauli X term and Pauli Z terms. And the Pauli X terms, they commute with each other. The Pauli Z terms, they also commute with each other. So this is a valid separation. And then the first order formula will give us this expression. as a good estimation of a short-term evolution. So it's basically the product of a list of evolution under the layers. And because each layer is just the summation of local commuting terms, we can totally construct this operator with only local quantum gate. And in this way, we can eventually simulate the evolution with only local gates. That's the advantage of this method. And this is only the first order formula. There exists a recursive way to derive higher order formulas. And the higher the order, the more accurate this unitary is. And also it will be more complicated. And to quantify how many resources we need in this method, we should do some error analysis. And the digital error of this method is quantified by considering the known distance between the digital operator and the ideal operator. So this norm here is the output norm. It is basically the largest singular value of a matrix. It quantifies how large this matrix can amplify another state. So there are a lot of properties of this norm that can help us to quantify the big data here. For example, if the state is already normalized, then the vector norm of this vector is directly bounded by A. And also any unitary operator does not change the norm of the operator of any matrix. And this norm also satisfies a strong sub-additivity property. So from the first relation, we know that the worst case vector norm distance between the digital evolved state and the ideal state is directly bounded by this big data. That's why this quantity can reflect the digital error of this method. And now the question becomes, how do we quantify this term properly? So using these two relations, we can first relate the shorter error of this entire process to the shorter error of a single step. And approximately, this satisfies a linear relation. And then we can use all kinds of methods like a differential equation or BCH formula or Magnus expansion to analyze this term. And in the recent paper, people can prove that for the first order formula, the norm distance between of a single step is proportional to a prefactor times T squared. And this prefactor is relevant to the local terms in the shorter formula. And for the Hamiltonian is too local, then we can also prove this prefactor is just proportional to n, which sucks the Hamiltonian. And finally, based on the estimation of the norm distance, the simulation time, and its Hamiltonian, we will determine what is the proper choice of the shorter number. And the shorter number is directly related to the circuit depth, which is how many resources we need. And in the first order formula, the upper bound of the norm distance is proportional to error times delta t squared, where the first error comes from the linear relation and the second delta t squared is the error of a single step. So reversely, the shorter number should be proportional to t squared over epsilon. And this is a very simple introduction to this product form method. And in the left hand side is a list of notations that will be used in the analysis. We have our simulation time, little t, and the shorter step, delta t. And the shorter number is big R. So these three numbers, they satisfy linear relation. And the n is the number of sides. It's basically how wide the quantum circuit is. And epsilon is the expected error, which is the proper upper bound of the norm distance between the two unitaries, the big delta here. So on the right-hand side is a simple illustration of this algorithm. And the Hamiltonian we simulate is H1 plus H2 plus H3 plus H4. And we first separate the local terms into two layers such that each local terms commute with each other. And then these four quantum gates will be a good estimation of a short-time evolution based on a first order formula. If we repeat this procedure again and again, eventually we can simulate the evolution for a very long time with only local gates. And of course, this is not the end of the story. So recently people found that sometimes even if the big delta is very, very large, the quantity we simulate can still be very accurate. And we don't have a general analytical explanation to it yet, but our method might be a good starting point. So as a first point, we want to point out that the fidelity error is not always the same as the norm distance error. So if we want to quantify the digital error of evolution, instead of considering the norm distance between these two unitaries, we can also consider the fidelity error between them. So this number is basically the inner product between these two states, and f is just 1 minus the square of the fidelity between them, and the theta is the relative phase between them. So we can prove that as long as the norm distance error is not too large, and this is a very general condition. The fidelity error and the phase error is they satisfy a linear relation. So this means in general situation, if we don't have any further information about the Hamiltonian or the state, then the appropriate estimation of the known distance is already an estimation of the fidelity error. But theoretically, it is totally possible that the fidelity error can be a lot smaller than big data, as the short error, as the digit error can accumulate only on the phase. And actually, a trivial example is when the initial state is an eigenstate of the original Hamiltonian. And to see this, let's formally introduce our effective Hamiltonian method. And so the idea of effective Hamiltonian is very simple. We basically consider the digital evolution operator as an exact evolution under a slightly perturbed Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian has a different energy level and a different energy basis. And with this BCH formula, we can write the leading term in the perturbation in terms of this. So the deviation between this Hamiltonian is proportional to delta t, and the prefactor is relevant to the local terms. So in the continuous limit where delta t goes to zero, this effective Hamiltonian is exactly the same as the original one. And now let's use this perspective to analyze the previous question. The fidelity error when the initial state is eigenstate will look like this. So it's equivalent to ask, we'll start with an eigenstate of H. Now we let it evolve under a slightly different Hamiltonian. Then after evolution, how much amount of the state still remains in the original eigenbasis and how much amount of state is lost? And one way to analyze this is we start with an eigenstate of H and we first project it into the effective eigenstate of H tilde. And this effective state is just an eigenstate of the digit operator. So the only impact of the evolution is the phase. Then after the evolution, we project the state back to the original basis. And as you can see, in this entire process, the fidelity error only originates in the first step and the final step. It's irrelevant to how long the evolution is. It's only relevant to the deviation in eigenbasis. But this is only a very...
Excuse me, can I... So the PL or P tilde, is it the projector onto
Yes,
the
eigenbasis?
Okay.
Yeah, it's projector into the eigenbasis.
Okay.
Yes, but this is only a very special situation. We can also use this perspective to analyze a general situation. And to do so, we introduce these two notations. And the first notation, D, it encodes the deviation in energy levels. It's a summation of energy level, where the PR is a projector into the original eigenbasis. And this phase is the deviation in energies times little t. And the S matrix, it encodes the deviation in eigenbasis. It's basically the transition matrix between the two set of eigenbases. And then we can write the digital evolution operator in terms of this. So we start with the original unitary. We first replace the original energy level with the new one, with the D matrix, and then transform the original eigenbases into the effective one. So in this way, the known distance between these two unitaries can be quantified in terms of S minus identity and D minus identity. And here is the detailed derivation. So we first add a minus du and a plus du here. So, and then using the sub-additivity, we can separate the upper bound into two parts. And now let's look at the first part. This part is just a commutator between these two unitaries. And because identity can be with any matrix, and we can replace S with S minus identity here. And then we expand this commutator and use the sub-additivity. We can bound this part by two times S minus identity. And the other part is actually simpler because the unitary operator does not change the norm of any matrix. So this part is just D minus identity. So a quick observation is the first term is only relevant to the deviation in eigenbasis, and the second term is only relevant to the deviation in energy levels. And after some simplification, we can write big delta in terms of this.
Okay, can I ask one more question? So in this, so how do you define S? Because is there any natural identification of like PL and P tilde L?
If we know the expression of the first basis and the second one, then we can write all entries of S.
So you just label eigenstate from like a lower state and so on?
We arrange the eigenstate to make sure S is as close to identity as possible.
Oh, okay, I see.
So in this way, we can quantify the known distance error in terms of the deviation in eigenbasis and the deviation in energy levels. And from here, we also know that the first term is independent of the simulation time, but the second term, it increases linearly with t. So it means in the large t region, only the second part matters and the first part becomes trivial. And the conclusion here is eventually the known distance error is determined by the Trott error in energy. And since we already have the expression of the effect Hamiltonian, we can use it to quantify the deviation of energy eigenbasis and the deviation in energy levels. But if we directly using this quantity, which is the wires inequality, then there will be no improvement because delta H times T is also a very common estimation. And actually the standard approach is basically a refined version of this estimation. And the improvement of our method comes from a detailed analysis of the deviation in energy levels. And later we'll see that because the perturbation part here is very special, we can reduce the estimation by a factor of delta t comparing to the Wahr's inequality. So here's how we do it. In perturbation theory, we know that the leading perturbation energy, when the perturbation part is V, will look like this, where phi error is an eigenstate of the original Hamiltonian. And if this leading term vanishes, then of course the perturbation in energy will have order at most V squared. So in our framework, if this effect Hamiltonian, the leading term is off diagonal in the original eigenbasis, then the Trott error in energy will be reduced from delta t to delta t squared. And this improvement in Trott error in energy eventually becomes improvement on big delta because it's determined by it. Then actually this condition, it turns out to be very general for first order formula. So we find several conditions that satisfy this condition. So the leading term in the perturbation, and again, it will look like this, which is proportional to delta t and the summation of the commutator of local layers. And our first example is two-layer case, which is actually the most common case in product format, which we separate Hamiltonian into two parts. And now let's look at this commutator. And because HB commutes with itself, then we can add an HB here. So this part is just the original Hamiltonian. And this state is an eigenstate of H. So if we expand this commutator, it's easy to verify that this part is just zero. And another situation is real Hamiltonian. So from linear algebra, we know that every real symmetric matrix can have real vectors as eigenstate. So now let's compare these two states, these two numbers. This is a real vector, this is a real matrix, so this must be two real numbers. But at the same time, they are complex conjugate to each other. So we have two real numbers, they are complex conjugate to each other, they must be equivalent. And this will prove that in both situations, the leading term perturbation is off diagonal in the original eigenbasis, which also means we have this improvement. And the first direct application of this method is to reveal the similarity between the first and the second order formula. So the expression of second order formula will look like this. It's basically the product of two first order formula with half delta t, and one of them is reversely organized. And so it can be proved that the digital error of second order formula is proportional to error times delta t to the third, where the first error again comes from the linear relation, and the delta t to the third is the error of a single step. So without the improvement in the total error of first order formula should be error times delta t squared. But with our improvement in our framework, we obtain a similar result, where the first term comes from the deviation in eigenbasis and second term comes from the deviation in energy levels. So actually this result has been proved before with a different method, but in their method, they only consider the two-layer case, and we can generalize the previous result to the real Hamiltonian case. And also our method is more concise in my perspective. So as another natural application of our method is the circuit depth in quantum phase estimation. So quantum phase estimation is a very important quantum algorithm. The basic idea is we start with an eigenstate of the unit operator, and eventually we want to extract information about the corresponding eigenphase e to the I 2 pi theta. And the first part of the circuit, it serves to encode the information of theta in the first and registers. And then we perform inverse quantum Fourier transformation on the first register so that we can directly measure the theta. And the measurement outcome is actually the integer that is closest to 2 to the n times theta. with some positive success rate, like I think it's 4/π². So because the number, the size of n is finite, there must be some intrinsic precision of this, intrinsic error of this in this algorithm. And in practical implementation, if this unit is hard to construct, again, we need to trotterize it. And now we can use our perspective. That is, we write the original initial state as a linear summation, as a linear combination of the effective state and the part that is orthogonal to it. So if the initial state is our effective state, then the final result will be the effective phase, and there will be some trot error in the final result. But if the initial state is this part, we cannot even make sure this is an eigenstate of the trotterized unit operator. And then we have to consider this part of the state, as failure. So as a result, the successful rate should be decreased by a factor of 1-p. But fortunately, this part of influence is very not important because the fidelity between these two states is, when the trotter step is small, is very close to one. So the successful rate is only decreased by a little bit. And the influence that actually matters is the trotter error in the phase. So we want to make sure that the trotter error in the phase is smaller than the intrinsic precision of this algorithm. Otherwise, the trotter error will be detected, and we don't want this to happen. And this restriction on the trotter error eventually becomes a restriction on the trotter step, which also becomes a restriction on the circuit depth. And because our method can improve this estimation, and we can also use the improvement to reduce the circuit complexity. Our method also applies to other phase estimation algorithms as long as the trotterized unit is used. So here's the formal expression of our result. Suppose we have a corner circuit that performs corner phase estimation using first order formula, and the size of the register is n, so the precision is 2^-n. If we want to make sure the trotter error in the phase is smaller than precision, the requirements on the trotter step and the trotter number will look like this. And here's the trotter number. Is the circuit depth of a single unit tree, it's not the circuit depth of the entire algorithm. As a comparison, without the improvement, previously L should be inversely proportional to Kc. Now it's inversely proportional to the square root of it. So this is basically the first part of the talk, and here is a quick summary. And using Schrödinger formula, we can approximate a large unit tree with only local quantum gates. That's the main advantage of this method. And in our perspective, we consider the trotterized unit tree as an exact evolution under a slightly perturbed Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian has a slightly different energy levels and different eigenbases. And then we can quantify the norm distance in terms of the deviation in eigenbases, or the deviation in eigenbases and the deviation in energy levels. But if we directly use the wireless inequality to quantify the big delta, there will be no improvement. But because of the specialty of the perturbation terms, we can prove that. And sometimes this perturbation term is off-diagonal in the original Hamiltonian, which makes the deviation in energy levels a lot smaller than this estimation. And using this framework, we obtain better results in the estimation of first-order formula and the circuit depths of corner phase estimation. But actually, there's one important issue, that is our final result is inversely dependent on the spectrum depth. So when we estimate the deviation in eigenbases, the inverse dependence on air on the lambda appears. And also in the second order perturbation of energy, the inverse dependence on lambda also appears. But it never appears in previous analysis, and also it will cause a problem. That's because if the system we simulate has large spectral gap, then we can totally solve it with density matrix renormalization group, some classical algorithms. And it's actually the actually interesting case is when the spectrum gap decays exponentially with the size of the system. But because our result is inversely proportional to lambda, and this will make the upper bound too big to be meaningful. But personally, I believe that there might be some better analysis to eliminate this dependence on lambda, because it never shows up in previous analysis either. So this is the first part of the talk. Is there any questions? Okay, I'll continue. And after the analysis about the time-independent situation, now let's switch attention to the time-dependent Hamiltonian. If we want to simulate a time-dependent evolution, the first two steps with product formula, the first two steps is exactly the same. So first, write the unit operator as a product of a list of short-time evolution. And then using the trotter formula, we can approximate this large unit tree with the product evolution under local terms. And the error of this step is also error times del t square, like the time independent situation. But because this time ordered evolution is hard to construct on a quantum circuit, we still need to approximate it with a time independent evolution. So we replace it with an evolution under the average Hamiltonian times delta t. And the error of this step is also error times delta t square. So even if we can describe the effect of Trotter formula with our effect Hamiltonian, and there's nothing we can do about the second step. And the error of this step is as large as the first one. And it would be ideal if we can find a situation such that we can totally ignore the error of this step. Then we can only use the effect Hamiltonian to quantify the entire digit error. And in general, of course, in general, this is not true, but we do find a special situation that can enable us to do this approximation, and it corresponds to the simulation of adiabatic process. So the simulation of adiabatic process is a very important step in adiabatic quantum computing. That's basically why this is important, this simulation is important. So the idea of adiabatic computing is we first encode the solution to some computational problems in the ground state of the Hamiltonian. And the typical example will look like this, which is a S model with general transfer theorem term, with general coupling term and a general transfer reverse theorem term. And it turns out a lot of interesting problems can be represented as the ground state of such Hamiltonian. For example, the Max Karp problems in computer science and thin glass problem in physics. But besides exact diagonalization, we can also generate the ground state of a complicated Hamiltonian with adiabatic evolution. And the principle behind it is the famous adiabatic theorem. So suppose we have a Hamiltonian that evolves with time very, very slowly. And the initial state is the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian. And because the evolution is very slow, then approximately at every time step, the evolved state is just the ground state of the current Hamiltonian. In this way, we can transform the ground state of one Hamiltonian to the ground state of another. And usually we'll choose the time-dependent Hamiltonian as a linear adiabatic path, which look like this, where when t equals zero, we have our initial Hamiltonian. When t equals to big T, we have our final Hamiltonian. And the initial Hamiltonian is basically any Hamiltonian that is simple, which we can solve it easily and find its ground state efficiently. And the summation of Pauli X is a common example. And the big T here, it's the total simulation time. It also quantifies how slow the evolution is. And in the adiabatic limit, when T goes to infinite, the corresponding evolution operator of this Hamiltonian can transform the ground state of initial Hamiltonian, the ground state of final Hamiltonian. So in terms of quantum circuit, if we can prepare this state efficiently and construct this operator faithfully, it will be equivalent to solve the final Hamiltonian. In this way, we transform the previous question into a quantum simulation problem. But before we talk about how to construct this operator, I would like to say a little more about adiabatic theorem. So to formally introduce the adiabatic theorem, we need to simplify the previous expression with a dimensionless variable, little s equals to little t over big T. So the linear adiabatic path can be written in flows, and the corresponding operator will look like this, which is a function of t and the hs. Now, when t equals zero, it corresponds to the adiabatic limit. It also means the evolved state under this operator will be exactly the state we want. But however, in practice, we can only set t to be a very large quantity, which means the evolved state can only be a good approximation of the state we want. There must be some distance between them. And this inaccuracy of adiabatic evolution is quantified by the adiabatic theorem, the formal adiabatic theorem. This theorem is about the adiabatic error defined as the fidelity difference between the evolved state and the ideal state. And this adiabatic error is bounded by a function, which called g, is a function of t and h. And in general situation, the expression of it is very complicated, but as a simplified version, approximately it is proportional to the derivative of h and inversely proportional to t and the special gap lambda. So the lambda is the energy gap between the ground state and the first excited state during this evolution. And so let's look at this upper bound. When t equals to infinite, which corresponds to the adiabatic limit, this upper bound is just zero, which means the evolved state is exactly the state we want. And also we require the spectrum gap to be open during this evolution, because if this becomes zero, then the upper bound also becomes very large. So the inverse dependence on T and lambda is the most important feature of the Abaq theorem. And here's how we can perform the digital Abaq simulation using product formula. Now our first step is a discretization. We basically replace the ideal adiabatic operator with the discrete version, and that is the product of a list of unitaries. Each unitary is an exact evolution under the Hamiltonian at time step Sj. And the second step is trotterization, and that is we replace each unitary with a trotterized version of it. And a common decomposition is to separate the Hamiltonian into the initial Hamiltonian layer and the final Hamiltonian layer. And then we product each unitary together, we have our trotterized adiabatic operator. And eventually we want to compare the state generated from this operator and the ideal state. We not only want to compare these two operators. And this part of the error can be separate into two parts. The first part comes from adiabatic theorem itself. So even if we can construct this operator faithfully, there's still some distance between the evolved state and the ideal state. And this part of the error is quantified by the Abaq theorem. Approximately, it is inversely proportional to T. And the second part of the error comes from the product form itself. So we use a trot error to represent the difference between the digital evolved state and the ideal state. And the fidelity error is bounded by the norm distance between these two unitaries. And for first order formula, approximately it is proportional to T square over air, like the time independent situation. And then it's natural to combine these two parts together as an estimation of the total error. Now, if we only care about the dependence on air and T, the result will look like this. So from here, clearly there exists a trade-off between the two parts. When the T is small, it also means the trotter step is small. So the total error will be dominated by the adiabatic error and is inversely dependent on T. But as T gets larger, the trotter error will also become very large. So the trotter error will dominate. So the total error will increase linearly with it. But this is only an analytical prediction. Is this upper bound accurate enough? Can we improve it with our effective Hamiltonian argument? And to see this, now let's compare this result with our numerical simulation. So here is our numerical simulation, where the Hamiltonian we choose look like this. The initial Hamiltonian is just the summation of poly x, and the final Hamiltonian is a ZZ term with open boundary condition, where the number of set is 8, and we fix the total number to be 100. In these two figures, we want to compare how these three different types of errors evolves with parameter t. And the black line is the total error, the red dot is the adiabatic error, and the blue dot is the short error. And the second figure is the logarithm figure of the first one. So as you can see, indeed there exists a trade-off between the two parts. And when the short step is small, the inverse dependence on T is clear. And when after a critical point, the short error dominates, so the total error increases very fast with it. But there's an important feature of this figure that cannot be explained by our previous analysis. That is, the critical point where the trade-off is balanced, the corresponding trotter step is too large. This point is it's approximately 0.8. The trotter step is approximately 0.8. Now let's look at the previous estimation. When the trotter step is large, is approximately 1, we have another factor of t, which is very large. We have another prefactor, which is also larger than 1. So the estimation of the trotter error is already a lot larger than 1. But the trotter error is the fidelity error between two states. Theoretically, this is at most 1. So this means in the large trotter step region, this estimation is already not accurate. It's not actually not meaningful anymore. So basically, this is the main problem we want to solve. That is, numerically, we do not see the trotter error. We do not see the quadratic dependence on T. And this means the previous estimation is not accurate. It is still true as upper bound, it's just not accurate enough. And the inverse dependent on T remains true even for large trotter steps. And we call this phenomenon the robustness of digital adiabatic simulation. And the meaning of it is, in the large trotter step region, we know that the the digital operator, it already deviates a lot from the ideal operator. But the quantity we're interested in, which is the fidelity between the two states, is still accurate. This means that essentially, if we only want to simulate a specific quantum simulation task, we don't need all entries of the unit tree to be accurate. We only need part of the information. So next we'll look into a debug process to figure out what kind of information is important and how we can use the effective Hamiltonian argument to obtain a better upper bound. So again, now let's use our effective Hamiltonian to analyze this question. So again, each of the unitary operator can be considered as an exact evolution under the effective Hamiltonian, which is a function of the shorter step. And then in this picture, the shorterized adiabatic operator is just the discrete version of a continuous adiabatic path. And if this continuous adiabatic path is further satisfied the boundary condition as follows, which means that it has the same initial Hamiltonian and the same final Hamiltonian with the previous one. That also means this operator can also send the ground state of initial Hamiltonian to the ground state of the final Hamiltonian. So from here, it's natural to directly apply the adiabatic theorem on the new Hamiltonian as an upper bound of the entire digital array. And as you can see, this upper bound is a lot different comparing to the previous one. But for now, this is only an intuition yet. And the main problem is why we can consider the discrete adiabatic process a good estimation of the continuous one, and what enables us to do this, and what's the restriction on the time step. And this is basically our contribution in our second paper. So in our second paper, we try to compare a discrete adiabatic process and a continuous version, and to find out the region that makes the discrete process a good estimation of the continuous one. So we start with the discrete adiabatic operator, which is the product of a list of unitary. Each unitary is an exact evolution under the Hamiltonian time step S, with the time step delta t here. And the state evolved under the adiabatic path can be written as follows, where this is the ground state of initial Hamiltonian, this is the ground state of final Hamiltonian. And the inner product between them is relevant to the adiabatic error. And because the adiabatic error is not zero, there must be some transition amplitude to higher energy levels. And also there is a relative phase between them, which we call it an adiabatic phase. So our final conclusion is the integral that determines the adiabatic phase is a lot different from the function that determines epsilon air. One of them allows the time step to be large, but another one doesn't. And essentially, this is the reason why the fidelity error can remain small, even the non-distance error is very large. And now let's provide this conclusion with more details. So this is the outline of the proof. If we want to calculate the adiabatic error, we're considering the fidelity between the evolved state and the ideal state. And our first step in the treatment is we shift each unitary of each Hamiltonian by its ground state energy in the unitary. And the reason we do this is first, the only impact of this transformation is a global phase. And when we calculate the fidelity error, we'll take the norm, so the phase will not influence the final outcome. And also, after the transformation, when we diagonalize this unitary, the first entry of the diagonal part will be just one. And this will simplify the calculation a lot. And so this part is a diagonal matrix. Is this unitary operator after diagonalization, where the D matrix encodes eigenbasis of the unitary, which is also the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian at time step Sj. And then we only keep the first D matrix and the final D matrix and merge all other parts together into a single gamma matrix, look like this. So because the D matrix, it encodes information about eigenbasis, it's easy to verify that this part is just a trivial unit vector. It's 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. And the situation is the same with the final one. So the adiabatic error is only relevant to the first entry of the gamma matrix. And this gamma matrix is the product of a list of diagonal matrix, a list of D matrix. And actually the merge of the 2D matrix is the transition matrix between the eigenbasis of adjacent Hamiltonian. So in our analysis, instead of directly calculating the first entry of the gamma matrix, we are calculating the off-diagonal terms instead. And the reason is, first, the Because this gamma matrix is a unitary operator, this column here must be a unit vector. And then the adiabatic error is just the linear summation of epsilon L square here. And actually epsilon L represents the transition amplitude from the initial state to the L's excited state in the final Hamiltonian. And another reason is, if we want to approximate epsilon square here, we need to approximate gamma up to the second order. But if we only want to approximate epsilon L here, we only need the linear order expansion, and this will simplify the calculation a lot. So now let's try to perform the linear expansion of this gamma matrix. So now let's look at the expression. We'll first look at the lambda matrix. Because lambda matrix is related to the time step, and we want to study the property of this discrete adiabatic process when the time step is very large. So we don't consider it as a small quantity here. But on the other hand, 1/L is still a very small quantity. So this means that the adjacent Hamiltonian are close to each other. It also means the transition matrix between the eigenbases of the adjacent Hamiltonian is also very close to identity. So in this way, we can expand this term in terms of the deviation between the transition matrix minus identity. So this will be the linear expansion of gamma matrix. And also in the analysis, we require that the phase of the eigenbases of H are chosen to make sure that the transition matrix between them is closest to identity. And now let's look at this linear expansion. So the first part is just a product of a list of diagonal matrix. And the diagonal matrix does not contribute to the off-diagonal term here. And this off-diagonal term, their expression comes from the linear expansion. So from here, if you trust my calculation, the expression of them will look like this. So the little air represents energy level. The big air is the number of time step, and little g is the index for time step. This lambda air is the difference between the air's energy and the ground energy. And this big T is the simulation time, and H prime is the derivative of the adiabatic path. But from here, it's still not directly to see that why the amplitude of epsilon air is inversely proportional to T, and as required by the adiabatic theorem. And to see this, let's consider the continuous limit of this summation. When L goes to infinite, the expression of epsilon L will look like this. And then from here, we can use Riemann-Beck lemma to reveal the inverse dependence on T. So basically, we consider this integral as our new variable and put it in the differential form. And then after one step of integration apart, we can show that epsilon L is proportional to H prime over T times lambda squared, where the first lambda comes from this, and the second lambda comes from this. And yeah, this is basically a very simple proof of the adiabatic theorem. It also shows that the principle behind the adiabatic theorem is the transition amplitude to higher energy levels is being suppressed by the Riemann-Beck lemma. And it eventually wants to compare the discrete adiabatic process with a continuous version. So the question to ask here is, if we want the discrete summation a good estimation of the continuous version, then what's the restriction on the time step? How large can we allow the time step to be? And the result is actually pretty surprising. And to see this, let's first consider a specific example. So the general function that satisfies the description of Riemann-Beck lemma will look like this. And if the fx function, its derivative is a lot smaller than t, and the gx function, its derivative is positive, using integration apart, we can prove that the norm of air is proportional to f and inverse proportional to t times g prime. And now let's consider a specific example where fx is just a constant and gx is a linear function. And in this special situation, we can calculate the continuous integral and the discrete summation version. So we want to compare the amplitude of this number to find out the region that makes the discrete summation a good estimation of the continuous integral. So because the numerator are the same, so basically we want to compare the denominator. And if we look at this expression, we're basically comparing a sine function with x function. And the sine function has a very good property, that is, as long as the x stays in this large region, the sine from x will be smaller than x, but larger than x over 2. This means the impact of discretization is no more than a factor of 2. But in error analysis, we don't care about this factor of 2. we only care about the dependence on T and air. And on the right hand side is a simple illustration where the red dot is a discrete summation and the blue line is a continuous integral. And as you can see, in this very large region, the discrete summation, where the time step is very large, the discrete summation is definitely a good estimation of the continuous integral. And the difference between them is just a factor of two. But however, as the time step continues gets larger, when it approaches 2 pi, the discrete summation will approach 1. And this is also the region where the simulation fails. So now let's go back to the general situation. If this fx function, which is also this part, is approximately a constant, and the gx function is approximately linear, then this conclusion should also apply. And essentially, this is the reason why the inverse dependence on t can remain true even for large time step. And if we want the discrete adiabatic process to be robust in this sense, it is sufficient to let every epsilon error to be robust. And it will be equivalent to this condition. That is, we want for every energy level, the time step to be smaller than a constant versus the energy gap. But this is also not a very good estimation, because in the worst situation, the energy gap will be proportional to the size of the system. So this also means the table error should be smaller than a constant versus n. But it turns out this condition is not a necessary condition, because not every epsilon error is important enough to influence the adiabatic error. And the right-hand side is a simple illustration. We use a toy model to compare the adiabatic error with epsilon 1, epsilon 3, and epsilon 15. Whereas epsilon error represents the transition amplitude to the error's eigenstate in the final Hamiltonian. So when the time step is small, the simulation is approximately accurate. So the adiabatic error is dominated by epsilon 1, because epsilon 1 has the smallest energy gap. And however, as the time step continues gets larger, the simulation of epsilon 3, it breaks down first, because it has larger energy gap compared to epsilon 1. As a result, the adiabatic error will increase with epsilon 3 instead of epsilon 1. But on the other hand, the energy gap of epsilon 15 is the largest, so the amplitude will increase even earlier. However, the overall amplitude of epsilon 15 is too small to influence the adiabatic error. Even if its simulation fails, it does not make a difference. And this phenomenon, it turns out to be typical for the model we simulate, and that is only the rather low energy levels is important enough to influence adiabatic error. We don't know what's the criteria behind it yet, but with these properties, the restriction on the time step can be even larger than this restriction. And as last point, we'll study the phase error in the discrete adiabatic process. So we know that the state evolved under the adiabatic evolution will look like this. And previously, we focused only on the epsilon error here, and we proved that because of the specialty of the Riemann-Bagley lemma, even when the time step is large, the discrete summation is still a very good approximation of the continuous version. But however, the phase error, it does not have such a good properties, because this is just a very normal integral. So the deviation between the continuous version and the discrete summation is proportional to t over air times the derivative of this function. And this estimation does not allow the time step to be large. And also recall that the operator norm distance is determined by the phase error and the fidelity error. So in the large time step region, when the phase error becomes large and the fidelity error is small, the norm distance error is also will also be much larger than the fidelity error. And this kind of explains our previous numerical simulation. This is basically the second part of the talk, and here is a quick summation. And numerically, we find that the previous estimation of the total error overestimate the true digital error. And this phenomena encourage us to find a different analysis about the digital error here. And in our perspective, we consider the chartwise adiabatic simulation as a discrete adiabatic process under a different Hamiltonian, so that we can directly using adiabatic theorem on the Hamiltonian as upper bound of the entire error. And analytically, we prove that a large class of discrete adiabatic process allows the shorter step to be large. And essentially, this is because the function, the Riemann-Bagley lemma is very special. And the phase error does not satisfy this property, so the non-distance error will become very large. And another very important question is, how do we compare this effective adiabatic path with the original one. And this is actually a large problem because when the shortest step is very small, of course we can use linear expansion to compare them. But however, the phenomena we're interested in, it happens when the shortest step is very large. And in the large shortest step region, we don't have a very good analytical method to compare them. So we can only use numerical simulation to prove our idea. And numerically, we also find that as the shortest step gets larger, the spectrum gap of this effect Hamiltonian, it closes. And since the spectrum gap closes, of course, the corresponding adiabatic coverage interferes. We don't actually know what the above state is. And this kind of explains why the total error increases very sharply after a critical point. And this also means that if the system we simulate has very small energy gap, then this robustness can be broken down easily by the shorter decomposition. So this robustness, it might not be true if the dimension of the system continues as larger. And as one unsolved questions, we also want to know why the epsilon error, it tends to decrease with the energy difference very, very quickly. And we think it might be related to the Liebig-Rosen bounds or eigenstate symbolization hypothesis. And I think there's definitely something we can do about this question. So this is the second part of the talk. Is there any questions? Okay. So finally, I would like to mention another work. This is not our work, but I think it's kind of related, and I definitely want to work on it in the future. So besides the simulation of adiabatic process, people also find that the simulation of local observables also satisfies the robustness phenomenon. And that is to say, sometimes even if the norm distance between the digital evolution operator already deviates a lot from the ideal evolution operator, the simulation of local observable can still be roughly accurate. And the researchers also find that the region when the robustness fares, which is the region when the simulation error increases very quickly, is also the region when the eigenbasis of this unitary becomes delocalized. And the quantity is used to reflect delocalization is inverse participation ratio, which is defined as follows. So the first set of state is the eigenstate of the digital operator, and the second state is one eigenstate of the unitary. And if this eigenstate can be represented as the linear summation of only several states in the first basis, then the inverse participation ratio will only be a very small quantity. However, if the second state it spreads out in the first eigenbasis, then the value of inverse participation ratio will be proportional to the dimension of the Hilbert space, which is very large. And the researchers find that as the shortest step gets larger, after a critical point, when the simulation error increases very quickly, it's also the region when the inverse participation ratio increases very quickly. And in this way, they kind of set up the connection between quantum chaos and the quantum simulation. And for now, we don't have a very good analytical explanation to it yet, but we have some basic thought about it. So our first plan is to study the transition matrix between these two unitaries and to find out why the eigenstate will become delocalized in the first place. And also there exist some exactly solvable models with large shorter step. So we want to use these models to calculate this trend to try to gain some intuition. Yeah, this is basically today's talk, and hopefully I didn't extend the time, and thank you very much. Is there any questions? And this is a reference used in today's talk.
Thank you for the talk. So is there any questions? If you have questions, you can just speak up.
I have a question. So, you know, if I think about your results about robustness of the large trotter step simulation, how likely do you think that it is that that would carry through to imaginary time evolution? Like, for example, I think that, you know, when people do quantum Monte Carlo simulations of condensed matter systems, oftentimes in practice, they will take large trotter steps and argue that universality and, the critical exponents will not depend on the size of the trotter step. And, you know, I've had this argued to me before, and you can't really say much to it because there's no proof or counter argument. So do you think you could establish something like that rigorously, that the trotter step can be made large for imaginary time evolution without changing you know, for example, critical exponents?
I haven't used a numerical simulation yet, but if we look at the adiabatic situation, then the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, it also applies if the without this I. So even if this is a real number, it should also apply. But I'm not sure the dimension time adiabatic evolution is it a meaningful question or not. But in general situation, we can still comparing the eigenbasis and the energy levels, but maybe we can, there's something we can do. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Can I ask a more elementary question here?
Yes.
You might have mentioned it, but I can you explain kind of the big picture of the setting? Because there are several things that seem to be not contradicting, but against, there's some trade-off between several things that we may expect in a quantum computer. There is the adiabatic computation. Then there is the charterization, which involves rapid changes from one time step to another. When we perform simulation, we have very short time steps.
Yes.
And then to induce that, we may also have to apply very fast, instantaneous unitary gates, which in real life, they also take finite time. And finally, there's also the error. So there are four time frames. Do you mind explaining to me how to kind of layer them one to another in your framework?
So I think it's about the experimental implementation of adiabatic simulation. Is that the question? So can I say your question again? I'm sorry. Let me increase the volume.
So if I want to see how this can, it relates somehow to say if we need to perform this in an experiment, then I can see four time frames. One is the adiabatic computation itself, involving slowly changing adiabatic path. Then there is the charterization, which involves rapid switching between different time steps, what we want to perform. There is the error time frame, the coherence time in the actual system. And finally, when we switch from one form of the Hamiltonian to another, usually that's induced by instantaneous quantum gates, which in real life also takes some time. So I assume, not that I think the work needs to be feasible immediately in experiment, but at least do you mind explaining how these four time frames fit into one another and what assumptions has been made in the analysis?
I'm actually now talking about the experimental implementation. So in the analysis, what we care about is only one time, it's the total simulation time. And it appears in the shorter step, and but after the simplification, as you can see, it no longer appears in the Hamiltonian anymore. It's only in the time step in the unitary. But you mentioned that there should be another gate between these two unitaries. Is that the idea? And do you mean there should be another gate, a time frame between this the switch between the two unitaries?
I guess there is the big T for evolution time, and then the size of the charter step delta T, which tends to be small.
Yes.
And that I assume that has to be much bigger than the instantaneous unitary gates.
Okay.
And so, in some sense, I just wonder how the physics work. In a sense, say if I need to switch on a gate quickly, then necessarily there will be a very strong Hamiltonian that has to be applied to the system. Are there ways I can understand how to perform even the kind of trotterizing step for a diabetic quantum computation? I may have missed something very elementary in the talk.
I actually don't know too much about the experimental implementation, And I'll definitely want to like to discuss this problem in the, but we can talk this through email if that's, if you like it. Yeah, I'll send an email about this. Yeah, what do you think?
Sure.
Yes, I saw about that.
Any other question? I have one question actually, if it's okay. So it's more on the first part of the talk. This may be again a very elementary question, but so I think you were discussing the cases mostly where the initial state was the eigenstate of the original Hamiltonian, right? Or and not mostly, but the one situation you looked at. But how restrictive it is? Is there anything you can say for more generic setups?
So I'm asking about if we know about more about the initial state, how does that influence the final estimation?
So I thought that so one of your main observation is that in these cases so phase errors can be ignored, so the fidelity error could be actually much smaller than we think. I so that was one of the main observation, but I'm just wondering if this is something.
And for now we only find two situations that makes the fidelity error a lot smaller than the non-baseness error, which is the case when the initial is eigenstate and the adiabatic evolution. And also I think in general, we might not have this advantage. So about the first question. So if we know more about the initial state, we can actually use it to actually, personally, I think we can also use it to improve the estimation in the short error in energy. For example, if we know that if we know that the initial state has rather low energy levels, then we can use the perturbation term times, we can quantify the norm of the perturbation times the projector into the low energy eigenstate. And then potentially this should also reduce the estimation about the norm of the first part. And then this also becomes a improvement in the estimation of this part.
Yeah. I see.
And actually there's something about it, but I don't know how to extend this result with, merge this result with our framework yet.
For example, if my initial state is superposition of various eigenstate, then yes, we do the time evolution, or
yes,
then we have two sources of error, like fidelity and also phase, and then if there is only one eigenstate participating, so if we compute the fidelity eventually, the phase part just drops, so it's fine. But if I have many eigenstate, if these phase errors are random, then I expect that these actually destructively adds up, and it indeed affects the fidelity. So in order for this type of reduction to work, I believe that for each eigenstate participating in this expression of the original wave function, the phase error should have the same sign, for instance, some coherence of the error structure should be there. I don't know. So
it's, I'll talk about how do we quantify this term. This is a question.
My the situation I'm thinking is just some initial state, which is a superposition of a bunch of different energy eigenstate.
I think that corresponds to the general situation. So in the general situation.
Of course, it's the most generic situation, but then now, in order for such nice reduction to work, the phase errors from each eigenstate should have the same sign or similar phase errors. Otherwise, if the phases are kind of random, then they get destructively interfere with each other, like when you add plus, minus, and so on. So the reason why we can ignore the phase error for the single eigenstate is because e to the I theta is just, if I take the absolute value, it just goes away. But if I add e to the I theta, e to the minus I theta, and so on, if I keep adding it, it's actually destructively adds up. And then, so I felt that in order for this kind of nice reduction to work, we need some special structure in the phase errors. That was.
I'm not sure I understand the intuition, but personally, I don't think we need the estimation about the requirements about the phases. And so what I want to think about is this non-distance error is actually the largest norm. We can apply the difference on an arbitrary set of bases. The non-distance error is actually the largest value between the evolved state and the ideal state with an arbitrary eigenbasis. So eventually we only need to this value will be equivalent to look at only with one eigenstate as initial state.
Okay.
Yeah, hope this answers the question. And also from the derivation, we can see that the norm of this part is only relevant to the largest deviation, the largest norm between the.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Okay. Thanks. And.
Thank you.
Is there any other question? Okay. So if not, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.
Thank you.